So, as Dr. Turco just said, I'll be talking about Campylobacter jejuni. It's a commensal organism that's commonly associated with poultry litter. Probably most of you have only heard of it from people that have gotten gastroenteritis after they've eaten undercooked chicken. But it's also in swine and in cattle, and it colonizes the gastrointestinal tract of many different species and is found in the manure of many of those species. But then once it gets out into the environment, it's very sensitive to environmental conditions. It is sensitive to desiccation, to UV radiation, to temperature fluctuations, and it's a microaerophile, so it likes very low oxygen tension. So you would actually think it wouldn't be an important environmental pathogen, but it's actually one of the leading causes, identified sources of waterborne disease outbreaks in the United States, and it's the leading cause of gastroenteritis in the world, causing more cases of gastroenteritis than Salmonella and Shigella combined. And I'm actually going to try to tie this in a little bit to Hurricane Katrina's storm event. And it does flow a little bit in that way. But in many severe weather outbreaks, the incidence of these water and manure-borne pathogens actually increase. And so two of the largest outbreaks that's occurred in North America followed heavy rainfall events. So many of you probably heard of the 400,000 people that became infected with Cryptosporidium in Milwaukee. And then there was an outbreak in Ontario, Canada, where people got E. coli 0157 and Campy. Other smaller outbreaks of 2,000 or 3,000 people in rural communities that become infected after eating usually non-chlorinated water or water after there's been a heavy rainfall. So these pathogens are usually transmitted to humans or other livestock through contaminated water that comes from agricultural runoff. The runoff can come from either recently applied manure or from floods in manure waste storage systems, or from, as in the case in Mississippi, when there's livestock rearing facilities are destroyed. And much of that runoff ends up in our groundwater system or in surface waters, also known as our drinking water systems. So this is actually some data from the Southern Florida Water Management District, and this is the path that Katrina took over Southern Florida. And it shows the rainfall levels, and you can see there was like a foot of rain dropped in some areas in Southern Florida. These are three wells from the Biscayne Aquifer in Southern, that's actually the drinking water source for South Florida. And as you can see, the hurricane did have a pretty significant impact on groundwater levels. They increased from about a foot to over 4 feet. So these storm events can have major impact on these groundwater sources, which ultimately end up being your drinking water source. So what we were interested in is finding out how this pathogen, Campylobacter jejuni, how often it occurs in poultry litter, and then how long it can persist in litter once it gets into it, and is it affected by litter amendments. And then if it is in litter that's applied to the soil, can it be transported into the environment, and how long could it survive in groundwater sources? So this was actually kind of an informal survey that we ended up doing because I was doing some experiments with chicken litter, and I was trying to look at the limit of detection in my real-time PCR method. And I tested several litters before and never always came up with Campy negative, Campy negative. And then I ran this, of course, ran this experiment with, in which I fortunately had my negative control, but I inoculated in different levels of Campy, and I found out that the manure was actually naturally contaminated with way higher levels than I was inoculating in. So I decided to go to pretty much all of the poultry litter samples that we had in the lab. I show 11 here mainly because we have the a lot of the physical and chemical data for those. We actually have two other sources. But the litters came from Mississippi, Kentucky, Oklahoma. They were had bedding materials that were sawdust, rice hulls, wood shavings, so a variety of characteristics to the litter. And the ones shown in yellow here, there were four of them that actually came up Campy positive by real-time PCR. These are levels times 10 to the 6 cells per gram of litter. So those are actually fairly high concentrations. And you can see this is one from Kentucky. That's actually 2 × 10^7 cells per gram of litter. And we found that these somewhat correlated with total cell counts. So the most of these, 3 of the 4 at least, had higher total cell numbers as well as Campylobacter concentrations. But then we started to go into, hey, is there some, you know, key factor that's going to increase the incidence of Campylobacter presence in the litter? And it was actually a total survey of what our bedding materials were, one in sawdust, one that had minimal, one that had rice hulls, one with wood shavings. So there was really nothing there, nothing in terms of pH or total nitrogen or carbon. We had a few other chemical measurements, and we really didn't see any correlation with campy levels. But then looking at moisture, you can see that the lower moisture litters had the incidence of Campylobacter. So basically what we found was that this says 36, but really if you include the other litters we had, I would say about 30% of the litters did have campy. They came from different states. It didn't depend on bedding material. But in the litters with the lowest moisture content, we had the greatest incidence of campy contamination. And I was really surprised by that. As I said at the beginning of the talk, campy is very sensitive to desiccation. So, and actually in the literature, you'll find a lot of the work with Campylobacter, they don't even consider the poultry litter because it's supposedly such an environmentally sensitive organism, and because poultry litter is so dry, they just assume that it wouldn't survive in that environment. And, you know, harkening back to Dr. Harwood's talk, you know, I'm measuring by real-time PCR, so these can be live cells or they can be dead cells, but no matter what, they're cells that are actually present in the litter. And, the, you know, like I said, this is a survey, so it's really hard to tell exactly why they correlated to low moisture content, but it's pretty clear. So next we wanted to know if campy is present in the litter, how long can it survive? We had litter from Kentucky. It's one of the ones that I just showed you that had 2 × 10^7 campy cells per gram of the litter. And we took triplicates of the litter and added alum to acidify it, 10%, and then we had triplicates that we left untreated, and then they were maintained at 30 degrees, or at 30% moisture, 25 degrees for several months, and I measured campy die-off in those samples. And this is the data for the different weeks of the experiment. This is the percent survival of campy, and in red is the alum-treated samples, and in yellow is the normal litter. And I'll just show you, this is the pH data for in the alum-treated sample. Obviously, the pH was very low to start out, and by 8 weeks, it had increased to over 7, which is the point in which you get ammonia production, and the normal litter oscillated right around 8 to 9. And as you can see, the campy died off was always, it was consistently lower in the alum-treated litter, and it was completely gone by 6 weeks in alum-treated litter, and gone by 8 weeks in the normal litter. But the alum treatment definitely seemed to decrease the survival rate. And this die-off is most likely related to the low pH in the litter. And this has been found in other studies. People have done research monitoring E. coli, enterococci, other fecal coliforms, and they find that they die off more quickly in alum-treated litters. Same way with nitrifiers, they're not as active in acidified litter. And we actually, in this same litter, we did a pretty thorough study of the total microbial population. And you know, I've been constantly amazed by poultry litter and the high concentration of organisms, 10^9, 10^10 cells per gram of litter. So there's just a lot of bugs in that stuff. And usually you'll find the bacteria aren't so easily affected by any kind of treatment that you want to try. But we found that there was really a significant impact on the microbial population in alum-treated litter. And we've actually got a poster on Wednesday that talks about how that population changed and the effects of alum treatment. So if campy is in the litter and it can survive until it's going to be applied to the land, will it be transported into the soil column? This is actually really preliminary data that we have. We actually took litter that was not contaminated with campy. We added 7 × 10^7 cells per gram, And then we added the litter over a soil column, repacked soil column, and rained on it 2 inches over a two-hour period of time, and then looked at how much campy we got out in the leachate. And we actually had two columns, and they were pretty significantly different in terms of the way that the campy leached out and how much we got back. So in the first column, in the first day we got about 10 to the third cells per gram, and in the second column we only had about 10 to the second, so that's a log difference. By 7 days we weren't getting any more leachate out of column one, and then in column two we got some more leached out, and we had 10 to the second cells per gram. So we let the columns dry out, and then we rained on them again, same rate, 2 inches for 2 hours, and then we measured the leachate coming out, and we didn't get any campy back. Same thing after 30 days, still didn't get any campy back. And then we actually took the columns and sectioned them to try to find out if there were certain niches in those repacked soil columns where we were getting the campy storing up. And in that case, we also weren't able to get any back. So the campy concentrations were reduced, but they were at high enough levels to be infective. So about 500 cells are infective of campy, and if you have 10 to the third cells per mil, it doesn't take a lot of drinking of that to be infective. And we could still get the organism after 7 days, but what the most significant thing here really is that if the litter was applied and allowed to dry out, then raining on the litter didn't result in the finding of any campy. And so it really suggests if time is given to let the litter sit for a little bit before any significant rainfall event, there shouldn't be a problem based on this preliminary data that we've got here. And so we did a pretty extensive study of how well Campylobacter can survive in different groundwater sources. And being from Kentucky, we have a lot of karst terrain, so we have access to a lot of caves, and we just took different cave waters, four groundwaters, and we evaluated the survival of campy, and then we compared that to the survival of E. coli, which is an indicator of campy. And I'm not going to go into this because Dr. Harwood's done a great job of talking to you about what fecal indicators are, but as she said, to be effective, an indicator should respond to environmental conditions in a way that's similar to the pathogen that it's used to detect. And so a lot of questions have been arisen about whether E. coli is a good indicator of campy presence. So like I said, we took four different groundwater samples and DI water. We filter sterilized them, so there's no competition. There were no other organisms present. So this is definitely a best case scenario in terms of survival of the organism. And to one batch we had campy, and the other batch got E. coli, and then we monitored them actually until we got for quite a long time. And we did plate counts as well as real-time PCR. And this is the data for Campylobacter survival. This is time and days, and these are actually culturable numbers. So this is, you know, the amount of campy that we were able to get back. And I'm not gonna go into a lot of detail about what the different water sources are, but they had different nutrient makeups. There's just a couple of things I wanted to point out. One is, I don't show this point going down, but actually by 80 days, a little after 80 days, campy had completely died off in that water source, and for the most part, after 60 days, the campy was pretty much gone. I just want to point out two lines here. This one is for the DI water. So you can see the campy died off more rapidly in the DI water than in any of the other groundwater sources. And this is the Logston River cave sample that we have that we did some more studies that I'll talk to you about in a minute. And this is the same data for E. coli. So the most important thing I think here is the fact that after 84 days, you don't get any more viable E. coli. But you can see, any more viable campy, but you can see the E. coli is really just getting going at that point. So it doesn't exactly behave in the same manner in terms of the duration of its survival, but also this, for example, is the DI water, and you can see it survived very well for long periods of time in the DI water, while the campy survived for a shorter period of time in the DI water. And in general, the E. coli could survive better in waters with a high dissolved nitrogen content, and the campi survive better in waters with a high dissolved carbon content. So not only did they not survive the same length of time, but they responded to different water sources in different ways. And this is that Logsdon River sample that I was talking to you about, and you can see how, you know, in this length of time, campi completely disappeared, and it's barely getting going with E. coli. And just to focus in on this a little bit more, this is the survival of campi as measured by real-time PCR in these waters and by respiring cells, by a tetrazolium chloride measurement, and then this is the culturable data that I just showed you. In these samples, as I said before, the PCR actually measures live and dead cells. And in the environment, it tends to work pretty well just because dead cells just don't hang around in a competitive mixed community environment. However, when you have cold water with no other competition, you can see that these cells just stuck around and stuck around and stuck around. So it actually was a horrible measure, and you know, fortunately, it wasn't the only method that I used. but then, campi is one of those bugs, and this is a prime reason that you use fecal indicators. It's one of those organisms that becomes viable but non-culturable. So you can see by 50 days, you weren't getting any more culturable campylobacter. But if you measure respiration, there are still respiring cells at pretty high levels, 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 5th cells per mil, until we finished up the experiment. And then this is just the same data for E. coli. And once again, you can see by all measures, it's going strong the whole time. So in general, we found that E. coli and campi really don't die off at the same rates at all. The 90% rate for E. coli was about 130 days, and for campi, it was about 19 days. And they didn't even die off in the same water sources. They didn't respond to the water sources in the same way. So it really brings into question using E. coli as an indicator of an organism such as campi. That's probably not true for something that's more similar like Salmonella, but and so in summary, we found that the campi can be detected in about 30% of the litters, and it can survive longer in normal litter than it can in alum-treated litter. And then if it was in the litter and it was rained on right away, it was transported through the soil column in levels high enough to be infective, but if it was allowed to dry out, we really couldn't pick up any campi by any measure that we tried. And the campi can survive for some period of time in groundwater sources, and those depend on the makeup of the water source, and it doesn't respond at all like E. coli does. And just to thank some people and say I'll be glad to take any questions. So the question is, do we look at unfiltered groundwater? And we actually, I'm trying to think if I've actually even quantified the concentrations. I think we've actually done plates from these groundwater samples, not from all of them, but there's stuff there. I think there would be competition. I really think that this was a best case scenario. I mean, we didn't even mix the E. coli and the campi, you know, so it was just, if it gets in the water, you know, and just based on really nutrient makeup was the only thing we were testing there, how long could it survive?
Hey. Are all campylobacter pathogenic, or are there
no
pathogenic strains like E. coli?
No, there are different strains, different species, and some of them aren't pathogenic. And I actually I don't know a ton about the different strains, but jejuni is the main cause of gastroenteritis. Right, they go into like a protective mechanism. Actually, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, I mean, I just was at a loss for the reasons that you would see greater survival, but it kind of
it does make some more reasons good.
Yeah, and this organism, it seems to defy all odds in terms of how sensitive it is to environmental conditions and yet how often it's isolated in the environment. So that could really explain it once it triggers a defense mechanism and goes B, B, and C. Right. Yeah, I have a real concern. I really like using real-time PCR because it's quantifiable and because you can do a lot of samples. But I really, you know, every time I'm doing a different experiment, I really question myself on, you know, what am I actually seeing here that's real or not real. And with CAMPI, especially since it goes viable but non-culturable, and there's still the question of is it infective after it becomes VBNC. So, you know, again, these are kind of best case scenarios. This is what's there. It doesn't really mean anything about how effective it would be.
Right. We've done a lot of work in poultry litter, and it's really, really, really hard to pick up, and by poultry method, it's really, really hard to get it. So I think that we're lucky.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. We added we had the repacked columns, and then we added the poultry litter. I did it that day, and then immediately placed it on the top of the soil column, and then rained on it. So you know, I think I kind of get what you're going for here is that were the cells really even adhering to the poultry litter? And I have to be honest about that study actually. We have taken litter that was naturally contaminated with CAMPI, but the reason we didn't use it was because it had been sitting around in the fridge for a while and it had dried out, and so you know, all these other questions. It would be really nice to have some litter that was pretty fresh and naturally contaminated and add that. But yeah, it was pretty quick. We didn't even let it sit overnight, which I really wish that I'd done now. Yep. The survey litters, I would say probably most of them were probably from the freezer, and because I just kind of came into this as, hey, how many of our samples do you have it? We just took anything we could find around. So I would say most of them had been either frozen, maybe some had been refrigerated. So it was very much a mishmash of just whatever samples I could find. Right. No, we actually didn't have access to, and you know, it's amazing how huge these experiments can get with time, especially when E. coli won't die. but no, we haven't, and we actually have thought about that. And what we would like to do is more comprehensive study where we go in and take groundwater sources from all different environments and try to fill in all the blanks in terms of the nutrient analysis, and then also get some repeats. That's another thing that we kind of wish that we could have is, you know, more with high dissolved oxygen or carbon and high dissolved nitrogen so we could make sure that we're getting the same trend every single time. All right, thank you very much.